From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is journalist Sam Dagher. He's the author of a groundbreaking new book entitled Assad or We Burn the Country, How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. Sam Dagher reported in the Middle East for more than 15 years, most recently for The Atlantic. He was the only non-Syrian reporter for a major Western media outlet based in Damascus from 2012 to 2014, a period during which a pro-Assad militia arrested and briefly held him in an underground mukhabarat, or secret police prison. He was later expelled from Syria for reporting deemed unfavorable to the regime. The war in Syria is the defining conflict of this decade. From its origins in peaceful demonstrations for political reform, the confrontation between the Assad regime and its opponents evolved through harsh repression and the militarization and radicalization of some of the opposition into a regional and global proxy war. The Syrian regime has routinely committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, making a mockery of international hopes to protect civilians against atrocities. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad consistently attacked civilians and the moderate armed opposition, as he and his allies, Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia, saw them as the most potent threat to the regime's survival. Bashar helped to bolster the jihadists, including the so-called Islamic State. He managed to stay in power thanks to starvation campaigns that he inflicted on civilians and the remnants of the Free Syria Army and the vacuum left by the so-called Friends of Syria, an informal group of Western democracies whose lack of political will played right into the hands of Russia and Iran, allowing Bashar al-Assad to prevail. He has displaced half the population. 8 years of civil war have destroyed the economy, cost 500,000 lives, and spawned the worst refugee crisis since the end of World War II. Sam Dagher's book, Assad or We Burn the Country, gives a vivid and powerful account of the roots and the course of the conflict, setting it in the context of Assad's personal history and approach to power. Sam shows how one of the world's most vicious police states came to be and explains how a regional conflict extended globally. And Sam Dagher joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Mabruk, congratulations on this exceptional, groundbreaking book. What prompted you to tell this story and to start by doing so through the lens of a relationship between the Assad and Talas families?
As you mentioned in the introduction, I had the opportunity to live and work in Syria between 2012 and 2014. So I bore witness to the regime's strategy of pretty much crushing this uprising that started purely as peaceful protests. And then as a result of his decision to kill people from the very moment he took to the streets, day after day, it morphed into an armed conflict. I was there late 2012. It was already a conflict, a war, but by being inside Damascus, I got to observe firsthand the regime's counterinsurgency strategy, what the regime was doing on the ground, obviously with tremendous help from key allies, Iran and Hezbollah. At the time, Russia was providing political backing at the UN, vetoing all the resolutions. But the powers on the ground were mainly Iran and Hezbollah, helping him come up with this strategy to regain territory. So I was seeing the sieges of all these opposition communities in Damascus and Homs and elsewhere, basically starving these communities into submission. I was seeing with my own eyes the sectarian militias that had been created by the regime to fill the gap in the army, because if you remember at the beginning of the uprising, his army unraveled. A lot of the Sunni soldiers and junior officers either deserted or defected rather than shoot their own people, because that's what the regime was asking them to do. So I was there to see how these militias were stood up and what the regime was doing with the help from Iran and Hezbollah, and also seeing the aftermath of a lot of horrific massacres that the regime was committing. And more importantly, I came in contact with the militia leaders that were tasked by the regime to carry out this campaign. I mean, that was extraordinary because any reporter coming in is dealing with the official bodies, the Ministry of Information, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But I got to deal with the henchmen. I mean, came in contact with them and got to hear from them directly their unabashed determination to crush, you know, this uprising by any means. So 2 years in there, I come out in 2014. I don't come out of my own free will. They kick me out. And I see the world just focused on ISIS and almost saying, well, Bashar is maybe better than ISIS and we have to focus on ISIS. And there was by then an attempt to almost rewrite the history of this whole uprising by the regime and its supporters, primarily Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, and the Iraqis. So I felt I had an obligation to write this history down and make sure people really know how it all started and the root causes and how it became, you know, the war it did.
Speaking of root causes, Sam, let's go back to those root causes, because you start the book by telling about the relationship between Talas and Assad family. So let's go back and talk about that relationship, because that posed a choice for Bashar al-Assad when this uprising occurred in the wake of the Arab Spring back in 2011. Talk about that relationship and why Bashar al-Assad chose to crack down as opposed to maybe compromise, as your book says the Talas clan suggested he should do.
About the relationship between the two families, the patriarchs, Hafez al-Assad and Mustafa Atlas, met when they were at the military academy in Homs in their early 20s. So they rose to power together. So Mustafa Atlas was by Hafez al-Assad's side when he grabbed power through a coup in 1970, and he was his defense minister. And Mustafa Atlas was by Hafez al-Assad's side throughout the 30 years that followed, particularly when the regime, 7 years after the coup, people started protesting in Syria against, you know, the regime, because initially Assad came to power by trying to promise Syrians that he was going to open up the country, he was going to allow for some measure of economic liberalization, this is the father, and also to allow for some margin of political freedom and to open up Syria to the rest of the world. So people embraced him at the time, particularly the Damascene clergy and the businessmen. But then 7 years into it, they realized that he was only interested in building this cultish dictatorship. So people started rising up across Syria, students, university professors, professionals, workers, because the economy was starting to do very poorly, inflation was rampant, and there was corruption, of course, and these types of regimes. We know what happens when a clique is ruling and these crony capitalists emerge. And at the same time, you know, this public discontent is happening. There is an Islamist insurgency that is targeting members of the Alawite community. This is the minority to which Hafez al-Assad belongs. So going back to Mustafa Atlas, his friend, he is by his side as Hafez al-Assad launches, you know, a crackdown against everyone. Everyone is labeled a terrorist, whether you're an Islamist insurgent or a peaceful protester or somebody who's calling for a strike against the government. So he basically manages over several periods to bludgeon the Syrian people into submission. And it all culminates in a horrific massacre in the city of Hama in 1982. And remember, Mustafa Atlas is by the side of his friend throughout all of this, basically approving all of his friend's moves because he was at the helm of the defense ministry, all the troop movements, everything that happened during that period. So at that point, Hafez al-Assad realizes that he needs to rely more on his sect. So you see the Alawites taking over key positions in the army and the security services. So it becomes a much more sectarian regime. But the Atlas family is there, and the Atlas family almost provides that cover that he's in partnership with the Sunnis, and look, he has Sunnis in power next to him. Then fast forward to the son, who takes over in 2000. The Talas family plays a prominent role in the passage of power from Hafez to his son, almost like a monarchy, basically. You had the king die, and then, you know, his crown prince take over, and the Talas family's there, and they're there to help market Bashar to the Syrian people as this young reformer. And they're with him throughout that period. But then the uprising begins, and that's when Manaf Atlas, the son of Mustafa Atlas, who had been Bashar al-Assad's childhood friend, reaches a crossroads. You know, does he do the same thing that his own father did, you know, stand by the regime as it kills its own people? He realizes that times are different and that he couldn't be like his father and tries to convince Bashar al-Assad to negotiate with the rebellious communities. But Bashar al-Assad and those around him remember what happened under the reign of Hafez, that they needed to be very tough from the beginning. In fact, they were looking at it from the lens of the 70s and 80s, and Manaf says they take out the Hama manual from the drawer, this manual on how to crush this type of uprising. And I would say the guiding principle of this manual is the title of the book, Assad or We Burn the Country. Either they prevail and stay in power, or the country is destroyed.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is journalist Sam Dagher. He's author of the recently published book, Assad or We Burn the Country, How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal fan from Abia State, Nigeria, Okuru Blessing Chibuki. Well, back to our guest, the author of Assad or We Burn the Country, Sam Dagher. Well, Sam, so we left off talking about how Bashar al-Assad refused the advice of the son of Mustafa Talas, Manaf Talas, tried to get Bashar al-Assad from actually cracking down on these protesters. But Bashar decided to keep within the tradition of the Assad family, using violence to stay in power at all costs. So we see then the peaceful protesters being knocked off by snipers. They're trying to maintain a peaceful protest, but becomes almost impossible unless they are willing to just lay down and die. So there was then this need for defense. We see a defection from the Syrian army. The defectors became known as the Free Syria Army. Talk about what was the tipping point for them, and then what happened with them after that, and the struggle that they had in trying to fight the remainder of the regime's army.
So day after day, week after week, the regime was killing protesters on the streets. Every attempt by the protesters to occupy a square, just like what happened, if you remember, in Egypt, in Tahrir Square in Cairo, people thought that if they could amass in a public space possibly 100,000, even 1 million, that there would be strength in numbers and that the regime wouldn't dare kill them because all the world would be watching and the regime would think twice about doing that. And there were several attempts in Damascus, but they ended in utter carnage. I mean, people were shot on the streets as they were making their way towards one of the main squares in Damascus, Abbasin Square. There was an attempt in Homs. Actually, people occupied a square there. Homs is the third largest city, but immediately the regime gathered, you know, soldiers and thugs and even university students that were loyal to the regime and basically attacked the protesters, and hundreds were killed. Ultimately, the protesters did occupy a square in Hama, another major city. And at one point, the protests were attracting almost 1 million people. And they were calling for Bashar to leave power because already, you know, by August, he had killed hundreds of people. And the U.S., you know, expressed support for these protests in Hama, but again, did nothing to protect them. And hundreds of people were killed. And Bashar al-Assad took over Hama again. And at that point, a lot of people in Syria, particularly the ones on the ground, realized that they had to take matters into their own hand. This was already like late summer, early fall, that they needed to protect their communities from these constant incursions by the regime. I mean, the regime would go in and just kill people who were protesting on the street. So they began to, I mean, it was just people in the neighborhood who carried arms and tried to protect the protests. And then a lot of the defectors organized a loose kind of coalition of rebels called the Free Syrian Army. Again, very little support. But then some countries in the region that had specific agendas, like Turkey and Qatar, who were seeing the Arab Spring as an opportunity to bring in their Muslim Brotherhood allies, began supporting them with money, with weapons. And at that point, obviously, because there was a void, the U.S. didn't want to do anything. There was a vacuum. Saudi Arabia also stepped in. So you began to have this sort of competition between these regional powers over who was going to control the FSA.
Exactly. And of course, initially, interestingly, Turkish Prime Minister, then Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was rather friendly with Bashar al-Assad. They presumably went on vacation together, but he was unable to convince Bashar al-Assad to stop the violence. And as you just said, there was this scramble. You had the Turks, you had the Qataris, and then the Saudis, each one trying to split the opposition and arm those that they felt were able to achieve their objectives. And their objectives were probably, well, we need to get rid of Assad, but then what? Saudi Arabia is no fan of democracy. Turkey at that time also, nor Qatar. And then, as you said, the void by the United States and the so-called Friends of Syria, this was this conglomerate of democracies, right, European primarily. What about the role of Russia? Because I think that is crucial. Every time a resolution to condemn the Assad regime and maybe do something by the West, they had a veto on the Security Council. And that seemed to also deter the West from doing anything, which is extremely unfortunate.
Absolutely. I mean, oftentimes people say the Russians felt betrayed over Libya because, you know, they had backed a resolution that was mainly for the protection of civilians, but that was used by the U.S. and its allies to launch, you know, a bombing campaign against Gaddafi's forces and to support, you know, the rebels in that country. But I think it goes beyond that because really the Arab Spring was a threat to Putin directly because you have to remember there were protests in Russia right around that time and Putin felt he had to go in and neutralize this. I mean, it is the traditional Soviet Union and then Russia is seen as the traditional ally of the Syrian regime, but by then, beyond the naval base in Tartus and the fact that the Russians had helped build the Syrian army, you couldn't say like Russia was like the protector of the Syrian regime. Iran was a much more important ally at the time. But Russia really saw an opportunity to go in because it was observing. It was looking at the U.S., U.S. in retreat, not wanting to be involved anywhere, pulling out of Iraq, saying that Bashar al-Assad had to go, but doing nothing. So it felt this was really an opportunity for it to go in to amplify its presence in Syria, use Syria as basically a staging ground to challenge the U.S. and its allies and project power. And in fact, that was what Putin said in a speech to his diplomats. I think it was around the spring or summer of 2012. He said those days of Russia just sitting and observing and watching are over. We have to go in there and be involved in things on the ground.
And of course, how coincidental, just at the time when President Barack Obama was saying the opposite, we need to leave. He took the troops out of Iraq. He was not inclined, as you said, to get involved in Syria. Even the half-hearted attempts by the Pentagon and the CIA to arm the Free Syrian Army were unsuccessful. It's almost as if they were meant to fail. And then, of course, he was in a re-election campaign in 2012. I believe that may have been a factor in him not wanting to do more, just as his advisors, General David Petraeus of the CIA, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, all were saying we really need to support the Syrian opposition against this dictator and tyrant who is killing his innocent citizens in a barbaric way. And this was even before the so-called red line, the chemical weapons attack. So let's go back quickly, though, and look at Bashar al-Assad's relationship with Iran. Bashar al-Assad and his family are part of the minority Alawites, which is a sect of Shiism. And, of course, Iran is predominantly Shia. And to what extent do you think this was a factor? And how much of a decisive factor did Iran and its militias, that is Hezbollah in particular, play in basically propping up Bashar al-Assad and helping him prevail?
The relationship between the Syrian regime and Iran, really, to be more specific, the Islamic Republic of Iran, goes back to the basically inception of the Islamic Republic in 1979. A few years before that, Hafez al-Assad was getting financial support from Saudi Arabia, from the U.S. Actually, the U.S. gave Syria almost $700 million in the money of that period. And also, the U.S. encouraged Hafez al-Assad to go into Lebanon to protect the Christians and to rein in what the U.S. saw at the time as PLO fanatics and people tied to the Soviet Union and communists in Lebanon. So they actually encouraged Hafez al-Assad to go into Lebanon, and he did in 76. And all of this was happening also in the context of U.S. efforts to broker Arab-Israeli peace. You had the Camp David, you know, accords and all of that. But then Hafez began to feel that he was being cornered by the West and his relationship with Saudi Arabia was not as good as it used to be. So he felt he needed new allies. And then the Islamic Republic of Iran appears and he immediately reaches out to them and they begin to form this alliance because you have to remember the Iranians are in a region that's predominantly Sunni. They're Shia. And Hafez al-Assad is in a country that's predominantly Sunni, and he's an Alawite. So there's like a meeting of the minds. I mean, they're both from minorities and majority sort of environment. And then they begin to work together in Lebanon, where basically Hafez al-Assad is a key partner of Iran in creating and grooming Hezbollah. And the IRGC commanders are there training Hezbollah under sort of the supervision of the Syrian regime. So in this relationship, the Syrian regime always had the upper hand, basically, that Iran couldn't do anything in Lebanon without having to go through Hafez al-Assad and the Syrian regime. The whole dynamic changed when Bashar took over, because you have to remember this young 35-year-old
ophthalmologist.
He was an ophthalmologist. He didn't want to actually become the president of Syria. He wanted to live in London and work over there and get married and never come back to Syria again. But then when his eldest brother died in a car crash, he came back, and he was never his father's favorite. So he had to learn, you know, how to become the ruler of Syria. And in the beginning, he needed a lot of help. He needed a lot of allies. And that's where Iran and Hezbollah saw an opportunity. The relationship evolved even further when Bashar was accused of murdering the prime minister of Lebanon in 2005. And that's really when Bashar needed the protection of Iran and Hezbollah. At that point, they go in. All the doors are opened in Damascus for Hezbollah and Iran after the assassination of Hariri. Syria begins to supply all these rockets to Hezbollah. Basically, they're delivered to Damascus by Iran, and they're supplied to Hezbollah. So really, the relationship becomes, the way I would describe it is, the Iranians and Hezbollah become part of the house of the Assads.
In the very few minutes we have left, I have two very important questions. What you said about the relationship between Iran and Syria underscores the statement by now-deceased Senator and war veteran John McCain. He said, in Syria, our interests and values converge, which is why many people are very upset that the United States didn't do more under President Obama to help. Because when we're saying Assad has to go, that could have also weakened Iran, which is considered an adversary in the region. But that's a different story. Talk quickly about Assad's strategy to stay in power at all costs. In addition to following through on the legacy of his father, brutality, he both placated and played the West, which was primarily concerned about Islamist terrorists, of course, in the post-9/11 era, and he presented himself as the stable one. Talk about how he let Islamist militants out of prison back in 2011, right? Knowing that they would wreak havoc and that the West would target these militants instead of seeing him as actually the very person who actually created Islamist threat.
You have to remember, Syria is a state sponsor of terrorism, according to the United States. It's on the list since that list was created in 1979. This regime has consistently used terrorism as a bargaining chip, as a way to blackmail and extort the U.S. and Europe. And they've done this consistently since the 1980s. They're basically the arsonists and the firemen at the same time. They've continued to play that role. After 9/11, Bashar presented himself to President George Bush as somebody who could be the U.S.'s partner in the war on terrorism. At one point, the infamous CIA rendition planes were stopping in Damascus to hand over al-Qaeda suspect to be tortured by Bashar al-Assad. But at some point, Bashar al-Assad realized that maybe he was going to be next after Saddam Hussein was toppled swiftly in 2003. So he began to support the insurgency in Iraq, including al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, the budding franchise set up by Osama bin Laden. The jihadists were arriving by plane in Damascus, and they were driven by Bashar's security services to the border. There were training camps on the Syrian-Iraqi borders for jihadists. Then we conclude in 2006, the Iraq study report, that we had to come out of Iraq and we had to stabilize Iraq. And to do that, we needed the help of the Syrian regime. Again, the guy who was sending the terrorists there in the first place. So we begin this process of engagement with him, 2007, 8, 9, 10, where all the jihadists who were coming back from Iraq to Syria, he begins to round them up, put them in jail to show the Americans that he's actually cracking down on this problem and that he's helping them stabilize Iraq and to try to win some concessions from the U.S. The uprising begins. What does he do? These same people he releases, and they go on to reactivate all the al-Qaeda cells, to create new extremist groups, and to poison the uprising.
Exactly. And then they sort of work in tandem, that is, these Islamists and the Bashar al-Assad regime, because we know from the trajectory of the war that he almost never targeted them with barrel bombs or other air attacks. He was always targeting the biggest threat, the moderate opposition and civilians, which is really unbelievable that the West couldn't see through that.
Absolutely. But I would remind you, the father did exactly the same thing. He went after the peaceful protesters first. Those are the greatest threat to the regime. And even in 2018, when he declared that he won, what did he do? He executed a whole bunch of people in prison who had been peaceful activists there since 2011 and sent their families death notices.
At what junctures do you think could or should the West, the Friends of Syria, have defied Russia's veto of UN resolutions and acted decisively, not an invasion or a war or anything like that, channel funds and weapons to the Free Syria Army, helping at a diplomatic level? Instead, we all left a vacuum for Russia to intervene in 2015. Most diplomats and analysts say that unless you were able to make headway militarily on the ground, that's the only way you can have leverage at the negotiating table. But that never occurred, nor was a no-fly zone established, which could have saved thousands of lives.
Absolutely. I mean, on the no-fly zone, this was an idea supported by the Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, the Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, CIA Director Petraeus. They all said we would go a long way to protect people from the thing that was killing them the most, which is the bombs that were being dropped on them from Bashar al-Assad's warplanes. And all of the U.S. allies were pretty much on board. Everybody thought it was a great idea to basically protect people, save lives, and stem the tide of refugees. Because if you remember, people were fleeing to Turkey at the time, and having some sort of haven in the north would have gone a long way to protect people. But again, President Obama at the time saw it as a slippery slope towards an Iraq-like intervention, even though his advisors and members of his cabinet were saying otherwise. And you also mentioned, you know, the red line in 2013. And I know everybody focuses on that as the moment, but really the betrayal of the Syrian people began way before that.
Absolutely.
I mean, Bashar al-Assad crossed the red line at the end of 2012 by the U.S.'s own admission. I mean, U.S. came out in December in 2012 and said it suspects that he's already moving material to make chemical weapons and that he may have actually used it on one occasion in Homs. And then there were several occasions in the spring of 2013 when even our allies, France and Britain, said that he actually used it. So I would say the decision not to get involved was made long before that moment, the summer of 2013.
Just as we close briefly, Sam, as you see with Assad having prevailed, the country destroyed half the population out of the country, how do you see things going forward with this supposed negotiations under the UN auspices?
I think it's the greatest gift to Bashar al-Assad because the regime has played this game from the get-go, basically telling the world, I'll take part in negotiations in Geneva, but using this time basically to plan how to remain in power. Yes, he's still there, but he's somebody who is wholly dependent on Russia and Iran. Without them, the regime would collapse.
What are the implications or consequences for the United States, for other democracies, the failure of them to really help Syria? And also, what about the refugees who are in Turkey or Europe or elsewhere, yearning to go back to their homeland, but not seeing a possibility as long as Bashar al-Assad remains in power?
Yeah, I mean, if our priority is to solve the refugee crisis and to stop people from leaving the Middle East, I don't think we're achieving that by helping Bashar al-Assad remain in power for another 7 years when his term expires in 2021. Ponder this for a moment. There are 7.1 million Syrians outside of Syria, so a third of the population is outside the country. Most of them won't go back as long as Assad is in power. What kind of fair elections can be held with a third of the population outside the country? Number one. Number two, framing this now as a political or constitutional crisis and forgetting about all the war crimes that were committed primarily by the regime. I mean, you have at least half a million people killed. The UN stopped counting in 2016. The vast majority of them were killed by the regime. Just forgetting all of that and not putting justice and accountability front and center should scare all of us, because this is sending a message to all dictators around the world. You can do that. You can kill your own people to stay in power. You can do anything to remain in power, and nobody's going to come after you. It's really a very scary message that we're sending.
The book is Assad or We Burn the Country: How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. The author, Sam Dagher. Sam, congratulations again on this very important book, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Zubair Al-Tayeb. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.